This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome and thank you for listening. I'm Joel Hilliker. Earlier this month, Vladimir Putin found a way to secure 16 more years of power at the helm of Russia. This completely undermined even the pretense of him having democratic legitimacy. A lot of Russians are upset, but we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques explaining why their dissatisfaction is unlikely to drive Putin from power. In fact, this could begin a darker, more dictatorial period in Putin's reign. In our second segment, we'll talk about one of the factors contributing so mightily to Putin's power, and that is Russia's energy production, specifically uranium. This nuclear material is crucial for operating nuclear power plants, and it may surprise you to learn how much the United States actually depends on Russian uranium to run its nuclear facilities. This is a concerning national security problem, and we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller how it was officials from the Obama administration that put America in this precarious position. Then we'll switch gears and we'll talk about youth athletics. We just finished our summer educational program here in Edmond, and we emphasized the importance of sports a lot with our campers. Sports do provide a lot of benefits for young people, but they can also create problems if they're done out of balance, which in a lot of cases they are. We'll talk to holistic nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about a proper balanced approach to having your kids involved in athletics. And I'll finish off the program today by giving you some secret clues about your interactions with your spouse that can tell you whether your marriage is going to last. We'll start, though, by hearing about Vladimir Putin's latest power grab and the implications this has for Russia's future in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
At the start of this month, Russian President Vladimir Putin scored what appeared to be a major victory. Reports said a supermajority of Russian voters approved a constitutional amendment that allows him to reset the limits on his term in a way that essentially lets him remain Russia's leader for life. On paper, it looks great. But in reality, Putin's popularity has been steadily falling. And most of his people understand that Putin manipulated the electoral process for this vote at almost every stage. For weeks leading up to the vote, Putin had Russia's propaganda machine operating in overdrive. Just about every paper and news show were proclaiming that it was the patriotic duty of Russians to get out and vote for the amendments. Putin also enlisted celebrities to reinforce the message. He timed a major military parade to happen just a day before the week-long vote took place in an attempt to stir up nationalistic sentiments. And Putin's government also announced that it would be randomly giving 2 million prizes to the people who voted. On top of all this, Putin arranged it so that the amendment that let him maintain power was not the only item being voted on. Bundled in with it were numerous sweetener amendments. These covered everything from increasing wages and pensions to codifying Russia's faith in God in the Constitution. There was also an amendment to define marriage as being strictly between a man and a woman, and another one that made it illegal for any Russian leader to give away any of the country's territory. All of these measures are exceedingly popular among Russians, and since they were all lumped together, it meant that if a voter wanted any of these things to pass, then he would have to also vote in favor of Putin's power grab. Meanwhile, one of Putin's government agencies actually blocked the website of the No campaign for an extended duration. And a crusade was also carried out coercing public sector employees into voting for the measure at risk of losing their jobs. So there were numerous carrots and numerous sticks in the lead up to the vote, and the result of it all, according to the Russian daily Kommersant, was a turnout of an impressive 68% of voters. This number represented 57.7 million people and was 10 percentage points higher than the turnout back in 1993 when the Constitution was first enacted. The verdict from all these voters was a hearty endorsement of Putin's power grab. Official tallies said that about 78% of those who voted approved the package of amendments. Of course, the tallying itself was every bit as rigged as the pre-vote campaign. Or actually, it was very likely more rigged than the campaign. There was a pair of exit polls taken in Moscow and St. Petersburg, Russia's two most populous cities. These exit polls were credible and took it straight from the voters' mouths that a majority there rejected Putin's amendments. But when the official count was announced in Moscow, it said 65% were in favor of Putin's plan. And the final count in St. Petersburg said an astounding 78% were in favor. These are alarming discrepancies. But Putin prevented much light from being shed on them, partly by banning all international monitors, except for those that he knew were staunch Kremlin loyalists. For example, monitors from the Council of Europe were not permitted to observe the vote. Neither were those from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But several prominent figures from among Europe's pro-Russia far-right factions were allowed in. One of these was German politician Stefan Keuter of the Alternative for Deutschland, who lauded the standards of the Russian vote as being, quote, higher than Germany's. So that's an impressive endorsement. But the trouble is, many Russians were not convinced by Keuter's testimonial or by all of Putin's other theatrics with this vote. For the last 20 years, Putin has led the country, either as president or prime minister, and now, as Russia trudges through a period of prolonged economic malaise, his approval ratings have fallen to record lows. Yet, because of the new amendments, he's now set to rule for at least 16 more years. All of these factors are working together to create Putin fatigue throughout parts of Russia. In the city of Khabarovsk, the protests have been especially relentless, with tens of thousands coming out to march weekend after weekend against Putin. Feelings of Putin fatigue are also particularly strong among Russia's younger generations. They are disenchanted by economic pain, glaring corruption, and increasingly stifled freedoms. What was most offensive about Putin's power grab, and perhaps most surprising, was his failure to maintain an appearance of obeying the letter of the law. For the last two decades, Putin has maneuvered and schemed and manipulated in most every way imaginable in order to keep and increase his power, but he has always done so in ways that lets him claim, however hollowly, to be abiding by the rules. This time, the situation is different. Journalist Leonid Rogozin wrote about this on July 7th, stating, "Even by Russia's own very lax standards, the vote didn't remotely resemble a procedure that reflected the will of the people. It's far from clear today whether a majority of Russians truly supported Putin's amendments. And more importantly, most Russians genuinely don't know where the majority stands." For these reasons, Rogozin said, Putin's legitimacy was, quote, grossly undermined by the vote. Writing for The Washington Post, Russian democracy activist Vladimir Kara-Murza expressed similar sentiments. He wrote, quote, "For a long time, Putin has been illegitimate de facto, but now, by subverting term limits through a patently fraudulent vote, Putin has become illegitimate de jure." End quote. So there is serious dissatisfaction with Putin, and it may continue to mount, especially if Russia's economic malaise persists. But we should not expect it to drive him out of office. Instead, these trends may push Putin onto a darker and more dictatorial path in line with the leadership style of some of his predecessors, such as Ivan the Terrible and Joseph Stalin. These were ruthless dictators who dealt with any threat to their power, real or perceived, with brute force. Under Ivan, tens of thousands of Russians died. And under Stalin, tens of millions died. Putin has already proven himself willing to kill his people in order to prolong his rule. Here is a clip from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury discussing this in an episode of his Kiev David program that first aired on December 20th of 2016.
Let me read you this, which was written in the Trumpet February 20th, 2014, or in the trumpet.com, and it's talking about Chechnya, which is inside Russia, which had a death toll far in excess of 100,000 people. Vladimir Putin had all of them killed because, well, they were doing things he didn't like. He had killed over 40 journalists in his land. 40 journalists has been killed, and you think he knew about it and he was responsible for it? Well, everybody that knows anything about that thinks so.
For 20 years, Putin has placed himself above the law, and the people of Russia have played a role in that. They've let Putin attack his opposition, silence critical media, and otherwise bend most every rule in the books. They have played a part in turning him into a nearly untouchable dictator. And now if they want to give him the boot, it's very likely too late for them to make that happen. Putin's power over them is now too vast and his grip too tight. The Trumpet believes that Putin will hold the reins, whether a majority of the people of Russia like it or not. This is our stance because of forecasts in a reliable source, the Bible. Revelation 9:16 describes an Asian force that will rise up in the end time and field an army of 200 million soldiers. Chapter 16 of the book of Revelation calls this the kings of the East, with the pluralized kings indicating that it will be a block of several Asian countries. Ezekiel 38 names some of the specific countries that will make up this group and gives details about its leadership. It calls the man who will lead it, in the New King James, the Prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Here is Mr. Flurry once again explaining who this prince is.
But notice, this is a very specific and really astounding prophecy, and it gives the name of a man here, the name of the Prince of Rosh, or the Prince of Russia. Notice what we wrote in the Ezekiel booklet. Scholars generally agree that Gog is Russia, so they can figure that out. And the land of Magog includes China. The descendants of Meshach and Tubal have been found together throughout history. In Assyrian and Greek histories, Meshach appears in Muska, M-U-S-K-U, or Musky, or Mushki, all names related to the Russian spelling of Moscow, as you can read in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. What about Tubal? On the eastern side of the Ural Mountains lies the city of Tobolsk, named after the Tobol River. Derived from Tubal, Tobolsk was once the seat of Russian government over Siberia and was basically considered Russia's Asian capital. Rosh was the ancient name of Russia, once called Rus, R-U-S.
So this prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal is the man who leads all of Russia today. And in Mr. Flurry's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, he discusses this man in great detail. In one section, he writes, "This world has a lot of authoritarian rulers, but Putin is one we need to keep a particularly close eye on. His track record, his nationality, and his ideology show that he is fulfilling a linchpin Bible prophecy. The time frame of his rule also shows that nobody else could be fulfilling the Ezekiel 38 and 39 prophecy. I believe he is almost certain to be the Prince of Rosh, whom God inspired Ezekiel to write about 2,500 years ago." End quote. So, because the Trumpet has this understanding of who the Prince of Rosh is, since we understand Vladimir Putin's role in end-time prophecy, we believe that even if Putin fatigue keeps spreading throughout Russia, and even if his people grow tired of him, he will almost certainly remain Russia's leader.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. So you are talking about just how much dissatisfaction there is among the Russian people. Where's the evidence of how widespread that dissatisfaction has grown? How strong are the anti-Putin protests developing?
In the major cities so far, we've only seen fairly limited protests, a few hundred people coming out, and that's partly because there's a lot at risk. You know, there are very often illegal arrests that take place when people are protesting. It's not the situation that we see happening in the U.S., where you can go out and basically riot with impunity. Instead, you know, there's quite a lot at risk there. So for the most part, they've remained limited. But in Khabarovsk, which is a city 4,000 miles east of Moscow, way over, you know, on the eastern side there, the governor there was arrested about a month ago, and he was very popular. And the people understand that his arrest was entirely for political reasons and orchestrated by Putin. And so in that small city, we have seen what I think are fairly unusual large protests, tens of thousands of people coming out weekend after weekend. And they're actually calling for revolution. They're calling for regime change. Their placards say Putin resign. They're chanting, we want freedom, we want freedom. And so it does seem like that's just continuing to get more and more intense there. And yesterday, the New York Times called these protests in Khabarovsk a stark testimony to the discontent that Putin faces across the country. So right now we're not really seeing it in a visual way everywhere, but we do have kind of a microcosm there in this small city that gives us some indication of what many others may be feeling.
Putin has faced this kind of opposition on some scale for quite a lot of his presidency. What do you see now that is different than that, and what gives you an indication based on his history or what you know of the man, an indication of how he's going to respond?
Well, really, I don't see much different this time around. He has faced protests. There's been talk of a Russian Spring for as long as the Arab Spring has been happening, really. Some of the Russians sort of protested in solidarity with what we saw happening in Tahrir Square there in Egypt and beyond. And nothing much ever comes of it, partly because there are laws in Russia that ban protests from growing over certain sizes. They ban them from happening spontaneously. They have to be done with government approval. And if they do begin to grow, he has, you know, law enforcement on site at all times ready to really take action against it. So I think what we know of him with these protests in the Far East, he'll probably bide the time and let them dwindle down. I think at this time the optics would be unfavorable if he were to go in and take some sort of action in a dramatic way. And there's not really a need for it because he knows that the people will tire out. So really, I think that this time is not that much different in that it doesn't pose a legitimate threat to his power.
Well, I do appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Vladimir Putin recently securing an extra 16 years to his rule over Russia. He's written an article about this. Putin clinches 16 more years at Russia's helm. Now what? You can read that at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
America's nuclear power plants require uranium to function. You may not be aware that America is dependent on other nations for almost all of that uranium, including Vladimir Putin's Russia, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Democrats in the United States love to talk tough about Russia and to accuse President Donald Trump of being a puppet of Russian President Vladimir Putin. But when it comes to actually challenging Moscow, they are very willing to surrender American energy dominance to the Kremlin in return for money and power. Perhaps nothing illustrates the truth of this statement like the devastating effects of Barack Obama's Uranium One deal. Most Americans do not understand how important uranium is to their national security, but nuclear power plants generate 20% of the nation's electricity. That means that America's 98 nuclear reactors must be fed over 40 million pounds of uranium each year so that they can generate 108 billion kilowatts of electricity. Yet the United States mining industry extracts less than 1% of the nation's uranium needs each year. To make up the difference, America currently buys about 40% of the uranium it needs to keep its reactors running from Russia and other former Soviet nations. Financial analyst Max Katsko reported on July 21st that there's just one potential problem for American nuclear power. Virtually all the fuel needed to operate reactors is imported. The United States imported an estimated 91% of the fuel consumed in nuclear power plants in 2019, although the reliance on foreign materials is likely to increase. That's because the country produced just 174,000 pounds of uranium concentrate last year, half the previous all-time low set in 1949. But it requires over 43 million pounds to keep its fleet running. Now, the United States has about 389 million pounds of extractable uranium reserves on hand, and probably several times that amount in undeveloped reserves. So why is it so reliant on foreign nations? The answer is that the Obama administration allowed Russia to purchase controlling stakes in the Canadian-based company Uranium One. This company controls roughly 20% of U.S. uranium production capacity. Now, Russia already has about 8% of the world's uranium reserves, and Russian President Vladimir Putin has a strategy to get control of the uranium in many other countries. In 2013, Russia's state-owned nuclear energy corporation purchased controlling stakes in the Canadian-based company Uranium One, which has mines in Australia, Canada, Kazakhstan, South Africa, and the United States. This purchase gives Putin the power to increase uranium production in former Soviet states while decreasing it in the U.S. and Canada. American geologist Ned Mamula summed up the situation in his article, Russia's Uranium Gambit, The Real Uranium One Scandal. He said, "The bottom line is this. Rather than produce their uranium, the Russians may have cleverly chosen to restrict the already limited production of their newly acquired Uranium One license in Wyoming in order to create a shortfall. Then they later could replace the U.S. shortfall with cheaper uranium imports from Kazakhstan at prices that undercut the U.S. market. This is easy to do since the Kazakhs are not under the same regulations, restrictions, and rules that govern production in the United States." Now, this gambit has worked. Over the past decade, Kazakhstan's uranium production has grown by 28%. Meanwhile, Canadian production has decreased 29%, and U.S. production has decreased 95%. So while Canada and the U.S. are mining less and less uranium, American electrical companies may have to rely on Moscow for years to come. And the saddest part of this situation is that U.S. policymakers were not caught off guard regarding Putin's uranium strategy. The Obama administration deliberately handed Russia this power. In his book Fallout, Nuclear Bribes, Russian Spies, and Washington Lies, investigative journalist John Solomon recounts how the FBI had undercover agents inside Russia's nuclear energy company informing the Obama administration about Putin's plans to monopolize world uranium production. Since uranium is vital to U.S. national security, the Obama administration had to approve the purchase of Uranium One. So on June 29, 2010, a Russian investment bank with ties to the Kremlin paid Bill Clinton $500,000 for a speech in Moscow shortly after Russia announced its intention to purchase Uranium One. 4 months later, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton's wife, and the heads of eight other Obama administration agencies signed off on the purchase. So Russia now controlled 20% of the uranium in the United States. Fast forward 10 years, and the U.S. is more dependent on Russia for its uranium needs than ever. American mines are being closed, while Kazakhstan mines are ramping up production. To understand what is really happening, you must understand Bible prophecy. In his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, the late Herbert W. Armstrong proved that the biblical books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Joel, Hosea, Amos, and others are primarily books of end-time prophecy about the United States and Britain. And a prophecy in Ezekiel reveals that foreign nations will economically besiege the United States and Britain. Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 5 and 16 says, "For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days, so they shall bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, behold, I will break the staff of bread in Jerusalem. They shall eat their bread by weight and with care, and they shall drink their water by measure and with astonishment." Now, God is getting very detailed in this verse. He is prophesying about an economic siege that is so intense that bread and water are rationed. Now, it takes a lot of power to cripple the U.S. economy to such an extent. But a sudden loss of access to Russian uranium or Chinese rare earth minerals or other vital resources would cripple the U.S. economy. The fact that America was governed for 8 years by a presidential administration willing to allow Russia to purchase controlling stakes in a company so vital to national security was a curse from God. And if people do not repent and turn back to God, the Bible says these types of curses will intensify.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. For all of the accusations that Democrats have made against Donald Trump for being soft on Russia, there's so much evidence, mounting evidence, that they are the ones who really empowered Russia. This is very explosive information.
Right. When you look at, you can just have legions of it, examples of that. This one we've just covered talks about, the Democrats, they're accusing President Putin of being a, they're accusing President Trump of being a puppet of Putin. Well, in the meantime, it was the Obama administration that approved them to purchase a company that controls 20% of our uranium production. And maybe some people might say that, the Obama administration did that before the allegations of election rigging came out. But even after the allegations of election rigging came out, it's Obama-era judges and left-wing environmental groups in the United States that are shutting down the pipelines, like the Keystone pipeline and the other oil pipelines that the Trump administration's wanting to use to ship natural gas to Poland and other European nations to decrease their reliance on Russia. So the Trump administration, between its moves in Venezuela, trying to bring in a new anti-Russian president in that country, and its moves with pipelines, trying to ship gas to Poland. It's really trying to push back Russian dominance on several fronts across the world, and ironically is being stopped at every turn by leftist politicians who are accusing him of being a Russian stooge as they stop him from checking Russian dominance.
Right. Yeah, in his newest Trumpet article, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, he talks about the Obama administration actually permitting Russia to sell 100 tons of uranium to Iran. This is, again, more and more evidence of these catastrophic mistakes by the Obama people that have serious national security implications.
Yeah, that was linked with the Iranian nuclear deal, where they implemented that deal on January 16th, 2016. And under the terms of the deal, Iran was to pinky promise to not make a nuclear bomb while the United States lifted economic sanctions on the Iranian nation. But also linked into that, at the same time, the Obama administration, they approved for Russia to take 100 tons of uranium from Kazakhstan, maybe even come from some of those Uranium 1 mines that Russia had already purchased with Obama administration approval, for all I know, and take that uranium and give that to Iran. And Iran's now announced that they're not going to abide by the terms of the nuclear deal anyway. So they basically just gave them enough uranium to make 10 atomic bombs for in return for nothing more than a, like I said, a pinky promise that they've since gone back on.
Just the numbers that you present at the beginning of this report are pretty concerning. I don't think too many people have any real sense of how dependent the United States is on foreign sources for uranium, for electricity, our basic power, and how much of our power is produced in these nuclear plants. Now, you did talk about the fact that the United States has a lot of stored uranium, that we have reserves that would get us through any shortfall, even for a period of years. What is it that makes the United States relying on foreign sources, and particularly Russian uranium, such a security threat?
Right, and the uranium reserves, it's not like we've got like a bunch of processed uranium sitting in a vault someplace. That would be a dangerous vault to be around. But it's more that we've got, the reserves are in the ground. North America has a ton of natural uranium wealth that you could be uranium self-sufficient in. And actually, during the Cold War, we were uranium self-sufficient. We didn't want to be reliant on Russia during the Cold War for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, with like these deals that Putin's purchasing these uranium mines, and he's closing down U.S. production, and then taking uranium produced very cheaply in Kazakhstan with very little environmental regulation and selling it for lower prices, which, I mean, the U.S. goes along with it because we're probably getting the uranium cheaper from Kazakhstan than we could mining our own. But it is a similar move to what China's done in other nations like Australia, where they, like, you know, buy up all the dairy farms, close them down, and then get you dependent on China for its dairy. So if Russia cut off this uranium, it wouldn't necessarily be that the United States is like, well, we can't just make electricity now. You'd have to start extracting your uranium reserves. But then, like I said, once you've been accustomed to this this cheap supply for years, and then bam, you've got to go back to your more expensive American supply overnight, it is going to cause a spike in electricity that you're not going to ease into. It's just going to be like electrical spies go up very quickly, which isn't necessarily a nation-ending problem, but depending if Russia did that, depending on when it happens, it could be bad. Like I said, if America was in a recession anyway. Mm-hmm. And then you cut off the uranium, and you have to start using your own uranium, and the electricity price goes high, you could really exacerbate economic problems in the United States.
Really, the United States the fact that we wanted to be uranium self-sufficient during the Cold War, it showed just a certain amount of wisdom and recognition that you don't want to put yourself at the mercy of your enemies with something like this. And it seems like there are many cases where the United States has lost that wisdom, and that we have made ourselves vulnerable to enemies who, if they did want to punish the United States through these kinds of means, we've given them the means to do so. Well, we thank you very much for that, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's dependence on Russian uranium, and really how the Obama administration put us in this position. He has an article up at thetrumpet.com, Russian Control of U.S. Uranium is a National Security Threat. Go check it out. Thank you very much, Andrew.
And thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Sports can be a great part of a young person's life, providing many physical and mental benefits. About 40 million children were registered for team sports in 2018 in America. But one side effect is the increase in injury. About 2.7 million young athletes wind up in the emergency room each year from injuries. A lot of these are preventable. What can you do to prevent injuries to your children? To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist and personal trainer, Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello.
So talk to us first about just how widespread competitive sports are for young people.
Sure. I'll just go back to what once was. When you look back to American childhood, you know, that used to be a landscape that was littered with pickup basketball, recreational baseball, or soccer. I mean, I can remember in my early days, we were always involved in some kind of sport. You just get some kids together and you play. There were unstructured games. It played seasonally, and very few kids specialized in one sport. It was just a fun time, and we just didn't get too serious about it too early in life. Basically, it was until middle school or high school that we started thinking about competition. And I think these little leagues, town soccer associations, and neighborhood basketball squads are disappearing now. And they're giving rise to the club sports, the travel teams, and personal trainers. And I get a lot of young kids. They have increased off-season workouts. I mean, I've got some kids that are 7, 8, 9 years old, and their parents are paying for these sessions 3-4 times a week extra besides their workouts. So there's about 55% of American kids that are kind of swept up in this youth sports economy right now. And it just bundles them into this singular sports avenue, like one sport rather than multiple sports. And it just increasingly resembles a professionalized kids pro league.
Yeah.
So, and the comparisons are valid because there's a report by Wintergreen Research. It says youth sports have reached an American value of almost $20 million, $20 billion. That's bigger than Major League Baseball, the NFL, or the NBA.
Yeah. We have definitely experienced that with trying to put our kids into various activities. And it seems like no matter what it is, you've got a group of people who have really made that their entire life revolving around their child participating in that sport. It doesn't seem to be a matter how obscure it is. There's a group of people that are really prioritizing that in a major, major way. So is that, what are the disadvantages then of that kind of approach?
Well, there's many, and I think a lot of parents don't see that. sometimes these kids, they start at 5 or 6 years old, and I mean true competitive sports. So that includes everything from the intense training to the traveling. I mean, the training level sometimes is relentless. The monetary requirement to be in these sports for these kids is extreme. And think about the time invested when you're traveling all over the state for games and tournaments. So there's a lot invested in that. And the reality, according to the experts, is that kids should start competitive sports somewhere around 8 to 10 years old. But that still implies that it should be in multiple sports. And they should focus on singular sports in their teens. Now, there's a very good reason for that. If you're looking at year-round competition in singular sports, there's a lot of overuse of the same muscle groups. Mm-hmm. So, and that produces, well, it just produces injuries throughout the body. By the time these kids are in high school, you know, it turns into chipped bones and torn elbow ligaments, kneecaps that are cracked, and lower back damage. I mean, and a lot of these parents can't explain that. They just think it's, or they minimize it. So, but that constant repetition at that young age is brutal on the joints and growth plates of these young kids. So the growth plates are the areas of developing bones that are just the weakest part of the skeleton for these kids. And they haven't completely ossified, they hardened. Mm-hmm. So it's way too much stress too early in life and too intense for these kids. And now doctors find that these injuries tend to cluster at different age groups as well when you're in these sports. So there's heel problems that occur when children are about 9 to 12, elbow problems from 10 to 12, and knee injuries, you know, from 12 to 14. And girls particularly, they're more likely than boys to tear their ACL. And that's just that, that ribbon of tissue that holds the knee together.
So if a child is more of a specialist, say by the time they're in their teens, the body has matured to the point where it's not so much of a concern.
Well, it depends on how long the child has been in the sport. If you start very early, you start injuries early just because the child is still growing. And I just believe that a lot of these coaches and parents don't understand that. A lot of it should be about fun and not pushing the children too early in life. I mean, you can do some good damage. The best thing that doctors say and experts in the field is to make sure that these kids have a wide range of sports and that they just don't have those repetitive injuries. And we see them even in adults. An adult can start a sports program, even here in my training studio, and then we get repetitive injuries. If we're not careful, we have to start very, very slow, you know, because these ligaments and tendons, then they all of a sudden they get inflamed and boom, you know, a person is walking around limping for a little while. So you have to be very careful, even with bones that are hardened from life already.
Yeah. So how common is it becoming to see these types of injuries in young people?
Well, it's actually pretty shocking because of this seismic change to singular sports. You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they say more than 3.5 million children under the age of 14 get injured annually. And then once they reach middle and high school age, these overuse injuries rise to 50% of all causes. So single sport athletes are probably 75 to 90% more likely to be injured when compared to multiple sport athletes. And here's the irony of the whole thing. Being a single sport athlete and driving a child towards success, it rarely points to future success at the elite level. And I've seen multiple experts mention that. You know, in elite athletes typically try out quite a few sports and activities early in life, and then they until they discover what they're passionate about.
Yeah.
And when you look at that, you say, well, the multiple sports, they help these children become more balanced in life. And I see that here as well. You can tell when somebody's been into multiple sports, they move very fluidly. They really understand where their body is in space. And by that, I mean, they can take off and they can turn and land very nicely and understand where they're going to be. And then you have people where you ask them to take a deep step backwards and they completely fall over. They just have no understanding of how their body should truly work. So there are recommendations to reduce the risk, of course, of overtraining. I mean, sports say, or experts say, limit that one sporting activity, you know, to 3 to 4 days a week for these children. And sometimes you should take some time off from all organized sports during the week. And just to give the body a rest. And then, of course, in the year, you know, why go all year with these children? Why travel? Why put them through these intense training schedules? And then these kids just get burned out. You need to give them 2 to 3 months off in the year. But usually when the teams are down, then the kids or the parents give in to strength and conditioning coaches. You know, let's hand the kids over. And then these lingering injuries, they don't get to heal and their mind doesn't really get to refresh.
So, you know, one thing that I have noticed is there, and I'm sure that there are a lot of parents who think this, who are pushing their children into these events, that there are some benefits to, say, gaining a certain level of proficiency or mastery over something, or where if you are being trying to achieve a high level in a particular activity, that a child really can gain some tremendous benefits from that. Maybe you could just talk about the balance between, say, trying to encourage a child to really achieve at their very best, and other priorities and other, I guess, other values that sports would be able to offer with a slightly more balanced approach.
Well, of course, there are so many positive aspects of sports participation, and myself, I would never discourage a sport. Like, let's say a child really takes to a sport and likes it. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. We're talking about overuse. So again, when you tip the balance, you can go in a serious direction either way. When you're balanced, it can be a wonderful thing, and there's so many benefits. I mean, the majority of kids today have embarrassingly poor physical health. It's crazy. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that in the past 40 years, the percentage of overweight teens has quadrupled. You know, and so a lot of these parents aren't really putting their kids into sports at all. They're in front of video games. We know that. When they do, and those that do, they tend to have the other side of the equation. They tend to push too hard. And so they hurt, you know, whether willingly or through ignorance, their child's body. I mean, I have seen, or we've all heard of parents that have pushed their children and shouted and, you know, I mean, it's not a good sight to see that child actually limping and a parent ignores that. Mm-hmm. So, but somewhere in the middle, there's a beautiful thing that happens. You become proficient. You know, you give your body time to rest, and then when it's time to go, you go, and you become good at it. And it's the opposite of this sort of mercenary approach towards excellence. You have an approach where you're looking out for the child. So you don't have an attitude of pure competition, but an attitude of cooperation, and that helps the child. So you're looking to help the child better their body and mind, you know. So we don't want to mimic the adult counterparts we see today, where you have this hostile, win at all costs attitude, you know. Then you're going to have excessive pressure on the child. And sometimes you see children getting benched so that better players can come off the bench. And then you also create this diminished sense of self-worth in a child. And I mean, what's the value in that? What are we instilling in those children? So when sports are played in a right attitude of cooperation, when we have these kids that are building strong bodies and strong minds, they can be highly invigorating. They can be enjoyable. And kids love making friends. They love being encouraged. They love being challenged. You know, the end result should be to help these young kids build character, to develop sportsmanship, and a healthy relationship with the exercise itself. And that's what I would say is the sustainable approach to youth sports.
All right. Well, outstanding. Thank you very much for that, Jorg. We've been talking to Jorg Mardian about how to prevent injuries in young athletes and just having a balanced approach to sports and other activities. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, as always, for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Will your marriage last? Social scientists can have a pretty good idea just by listening to you and your spouse converse on just about anything for only a few minutes. When you talk to your mate, you probably don't realize how much you communicate beyond the content of your words. That smile, that tone of voice, that roll of the eyes. You are constantly, automatically broadcasting signals about your underlying attitudes regarding him or her. Beginning in the 1980s, John Gottman ran a lab at the University of Washington where he monitored thousands of married couples having conversations. In addition to videotaping them, he hooked up each spouse to electrodes and sensors that measured heart rate, skin temperature, and other physical particulars during the conversation. His staff interpreted all these nuances in order to register a specific emotion out of a list of 20, neutral, admiration, anger, sadness, whining, and so on each spouse for each second of interaction. That sequence of emotions, meticulously analyzed, provides remarkably accurate information about the health and the long-term prognosis for that marriage. In fact, if Gottman analyzed an hour of discussion between a husband and a wife, he could predict with 95% accuracy whether they would still be married 15 years later. Now, how is that possible? Well, essentially, his staff measured the amount of positive and negative emotion in a couple's interaction. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this in his book, Blink. He wrote, "One of Gottman's findings is that for a marriage to survive, the ratio of positive to negative emotion in a given encounter has to be at least 5 to 1. 5 to 1. A healthy marriage needs at least 5 times more positive feelings than negative." Now, this is interesting when you look at it from a biblical perspective. God knows marriage. He created it. He knows how it has to work, and he really keeps it simple for us in giving us instruction about it. In a single Bible verse, God spells out exactly the basis for a healthy marital relationship. Ephesians 5 and verse 33, it says, "A husband must love his wife, and a wife must reverence her husband," or respect her husband. Love covers a multitude of sins. It glides past the minor irritations of daily living. 1 Corinthians 13 says, "Godly love is patient, it's kind, it's never irritable or resentful, always eager to believe the best." So a husband who loves his wife never lets petty flaws overwhelm his underlying glow for her and his sense of appreciation for the value and the richness that she adds to his life. Reverence or respect is rooted in a deep respect for a husband's office as the head of the family. A wife who reverences her husband never lets his imperfections overwhelm her abiding honor for him and her loving respect and her appreciation for his leadership. When love and reverence form the core of a husband and wife relationship, there's a virtuous cycle of positive emotion that binds the two closer as time goes on. When there's an erosion of those basic requirements, when a husband and wife routinely violate that biblical command, then the relationship spirals into negative territory. And the longer that goes on, the deeper the damage to both husband and wife, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. Malcolm Gladwell quotes Gottman saying, "People are in one of two states in a relationship. The first is what I call positive sentiment override, where positive emotion overrides irritability. It's like a buffer. Their spouse will do something bad and they'll say, oh, he's just in a crummy mood." That is a believe the best approach. You give the other person the benefit of the doubt because you have a prevailing love or reverence for that person. Gottman went on, he said, or they can be in a negative sentiment override so that even a relatively neutral thing that a partner says can get perceived as negative. How often does this happen in your marriage? Whenever I catch that starting to crop up between my wife and me, I know we're overdue for a date. We need some one-on-one time together where we can really catch up on each other's lives. But when negative sentiment override prevails, one spouse feels not just like the other person said or did something wrong, but that there's something wrong with the person. He or she gets irritated not with what they did, but with who they are. Gottman suggests that our daily interactions are like a stock market chart with ups and downs every day, and then also a larger, more gradually sloping trajectory. And he says some go up, some go down, but once they start going down toward negative emotion, 94% will continue going down. He highlights what he calls the worst relationship killers, the emotions that he calls the four horsemen: defensiveness, stonewalling or turning away, more prevalent in men; criticism, condemning a person's character, which is more prevalent in women; and contempt, which is actually trying to put the other person on a lower plane than yourself. You can really see how the four horsemen, what he calls the four horsemen, these are the opposite of what we might call the two pillars, the love and the reverence that God commands. Give your spouse the benefit of the doubt. In your daily interactions, check to make sure that you're in positive sentiment override. You allow those minor irritations to just brush past. Let love and reverence form the basis of your attitudes toward each other. When you do so, you virtually guarantee that the overall arc of your relationship will rise toward a greater, more godly love for one another. I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Jeremiah, Nick Irwin, and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Dale Carnegie. Feeling sorry for yourself and your present condition is not only a waste of energy, but the worst habit you could possibly have. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.